Hey, all you players, you playerettes, you dudettes, amigos, amigas, everybody in between. This is going to be a special episode, not because we both write the short bus, but we're gonna announce a couple of things. We're going to make some changes. Just to let you know, guys, right up front, this is going to be my last episode with Murph. I'm going to tell you about what's going on, but there's some things I had to do, some things I had to change, and so may had to make some tough decisions. So, but it's not without some trepidation, as they say. It's not without some regret. But in fact, there's a couple things I'm going to tell you, Murph. A couple things have happened just in the last 2 days. So like it's the old thing, when one door closes, another one opens. So I'm going to tell you that. You don't even know one of these things.
Sweet.
It's going to be good. It's going to
learn together here, everyone.
Yeah. And the other thing we're going to do too is we're going to go back and just to close out, let's do a recap, because the last time we did a recap was back on May 29th. Of 2023, we did our greatest hits of episode 51 to 99. And now I said, you know, Murph, let's just close out. Let's talk about our episodes from 101, which we start off with Wayne Stinnett and the Curious Case of the Crocodile and Meth, which that almost, I wanted to sound like Keith Morrison and the Curious Case of the Overnight Oats, you know.
Or the Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Benjamin Button.
That's right.
Now let's go, you know, so you give that Keith Morrison, you know, kind of thing. But so what we're going to do is go back and talk about these things. And, you know, Murph, I got to looking at it too, not only between this and Patreon, we have got 140, this will be episode 142. But we've had some fillers, you know, when we took the month off, like December, that one time we had some, author things, but you know, that's, it's still 141 episodes in spite of the extra stuff that we did there. And we've got over 290 separate episodes over on Patreon. Jeez. Between all the different things we did.
Well, plus we had a couple of bonus episodes where we brought authors on here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's amazing how much has gone through here. Time has gone by quickly, I have to say.
Yeah, no, and it's just like anything else, time moves on. And so, you know, I'll kind of intersperse a couple stories as we go along. But there were some things personally that had to get done with me and my wife, some things that she needs to have happen, some things professionally. Here I was going along. I'm an outside advisor to a very large cybersecurity company, is one of the things I do. And along they came and they said, hey, we like what you're doing. We're going to double what we're paying you and we want you to do a little bit more. So,
well, let me think about that. Okay. Did you tell him you got a friend? Did you tell him about Murph?
I told him about Murph. I said, hey, you know.
And they said, keep what son of a bitch out of here.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. So, and then some very interesting things with the National Center for Open and Unsolved Cases. Had a very good, thanks to Matt Barden and Keith Bishop. Matt got me introduced into some people inside of Walmart, had some great meetings, and I've got a meeting coming up. By the time you hear this, it's going to be at the end of the week, but the head of law enforcement liaison for Walmart and the head of global security.
Wow.
For Walmart. Global investigations, I should say. Global investigations. And the issue of organized retail theft, I mean, retailers are going to lose around $120 to $130 billion this year. To organize retail theft.
Jeez.
So if you want to know why stores are going out of business, it's stuff like this. So there's a huge way we can impact that. Got some very good news from the U.S. Marshals. Very good news.
They dropped the warrants on you.
Yeah. Statute of limitations, you know?
Sorry.
they told me, whatever you do, don't answer the door at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So
that's a nice warning.
Yeah. So there's one thing I can tell you about, one thing I can't because it's in progress. But Murph, you'll understand. I'll kind of hint around to this. Remember what you talked about you've been trying to do for 3 years with a certain agency and just haven't been able to get it off the ground?
Oh, yeah.
Because they keep shooting you down?
Oh, yeah.
I got really favorable from the director of the Marshals feedback.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Well, you know, so, if you need a redneck hillbilly, come on there. I'm available.
You never know. Well, here's what happened. So I was on a podcast here quite a while ago called Truth and Justice, and I think you were on it too, Murph, the guy that runs it. But it came on, and I was talking about the National Center. You know, he said it's not crowdsourcing. But anyway, so I get contacted earlier this week by a guy who has produced episodes for John Walsh for In Pursuit, has had some of the top shows on Netflix for true crime. He's a producer. They've got a missing a collection of missing people. I can't give too much away because they're pitching the show right now, and they just included me in it. So we want to talk about using, I may be flying out to California to interview the families, but from a standpoint of the way we would look at it from our system, which is a lot of it's about, to me, location drives everything, right? When you remember when you were looking for Pablo, you weren't looking for, you know, you kind of figured out where Pablo was, but you want to know where Pablo is right now, right?
Exactly.
It was all about location, right?
Exactly. Yep.
And if you couldn't figure out where he was now, you want to know, well, where is he going to go? So everything that we have done from a law enforcement standpoint, investigating cases, everything revolved around locations, right? What's the location of the crime? You had to establish jurisdiction. You know, where did this happen at? Where were you at when it happened? You know, who else was around here when it happened? You know, so anyway, long story short is this guy reached out to me. We actually had significant interest, and I had to write him up some stuff real quick. He turned it in, and he pitched me the next day to be part of the show, and I think it's going to be for Netflix. So
sweet.
So we will see what happens.
See, we can anyway, all of us kind of say we knew Morgan when.
Well, and then there was something else too that happened. I went to the career authors writing retreat at MIT at Endicott House here a couple weeks ago. This is while you were off jaunting around Micronesia, which we need to catch up on that too. And discovering stuff, mm-hmm. which is going to be huge. As I say, it's going to be huge. It's going to be bigly huge.
Let's
for
hope.
Steve. Let's put it this way. It was more than what you had the first four times.
Absolutely. It's, you know, the challenge we're having now is getting the items back to the United States. It's costing us like almost $2,000 to ship it back over here.
But what about customs?
That's part of it. They'll get it through. I mean, it's concrete, so there won't be a whole lot of, unless there's coke hidden in it. I don't think there is.
Well, and we have an episode about people hiding coke in concrete. I think that was Matt Barden.
Yep. By the way, you mentioned, Matt Barden and Keith Bishop helped you with this project. Both former guests here on the Game of Crimes.
Both former DEA.
Yep.
And Keith, just remember, Keith Bishop played for the Broncos, played with John Elway. He's number 54 in your program, but number one in your heart.
Absolutely. So, absolutely.
Is what he said. So I go to this writing retreat, and one of the people I end up meeting is a guy named Brian Andrews. He is a former naval officer, submarine officer, mm-hmm. on a nuke. And him and his partner write a series of thrillers. And remember when we had Mark Cameron on?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was writing for the Tom Clancy estate. These guys took over from Mark Cameron, and now they're writing the next installment of Tom Clancy novels. And so they've had 20, 25 number one hits, bestsellers. They've got several things being optioned right now. They've got some series in development, kind of like Jack Carr with The Terminal List, mm-hmm. you know, things that hit Amazon. And so I got, let's put it this way. It's the kind of feedback you get from somebody where you go, okay, you either got to shit or get off the pot, you know? He says, if you're going to do this, you need to put the time in. You need, so as even as we're sitting here, I'll show you, you can't see this. This is me going back chapter by chapter, paragraph by paragraph, sentence by sentence, and taking newfound ways of looking at things from them and editing everything. So I'm up to chapter 20 right now.
This is your book?
75. Yeah.
Wow.
But it's like, well, so I'm going to be at Thriller Fest at the end of May, first day of June. And I'm already set up to pitch a lot of agents. So he says, yeah, you'll be done. You'll be ready to go. Plus, I ran into a guy who, as part of the panel, but he's an editor that worked for Random House, Scholastic. I mean, he's edited for all the big companies, mm-hmm. for big authors. And he says, look, I told him, I said, hey, look, I'd like somebody, one final pass, like with somebody like you to do it. So it's going to work out really good. I'm going to edit what I can do now, get it really tight, go up to Thriller Fest, learn some things, pitch some agents. And then he's going to take my book from there and edit it. It'll take him about 2 weeks because when he does it, he does one book at a time and just goes, you know, front to back.
Right.
And by that time, it'll be fine because a lot of agents, you know, the summer things slow down. So I'll be in a perfect position to go pitch this. So things were looking up. So it's kind of like, you know, bring it full circle, had to make some decisions. And this was a tough decision. It's kind of like there's so many hours in a day.
Right.
And you know, I've talked, we've got more days behind us than we have ahead of us. Right. So,
well, you might, I'm not, I'm planning on staying to, I'm like 120 But wait a minute, that's not even enough. I have to go
Connie ain't
going to
allow that. That ain't going to happen. Not with you're going to do something to piss her off, and one morning you and Big Al both are going to, disappeared.
I flew back in last night from South Lake Tahoe. Javier and I were out there speaking at a FBI National Academy Associates conference. And, of course, my flight was 3.5 hours late, got, plane problems, mechanical issues. Murphy's Law kicks in again. But I saw a text message when I landed here in Orlando from Connie to the kids saying that not only did she see Big Al, but she saw Big Al's girlfriend out here in the lake. So, this is gator mating season right now. So it's she could get rid of my body very quickly if she so chose.
So if you arrange dates between alligators, are you a gator mater?
Oh, my gosh. You know what? I do have a mute butt here, but I'd probably get
you have the power now.
And everybody, just to add on a little bit, Morgan's leaving. Game of Crimes is going to continue. Murphy's going to try this solo for a while and see what happens. I love what we're doing. I love the guests we have on. The love that we get from all our listeners, please stay with me. Tell your friends. We're going to try and grow the show. We're going to continue to bring on some fantastic guests. And once Morgan gets his book out, we're going to have him back on. He'll tell you all about his book. Of course, we'll post it just like we do all the other books on our book list. We might bump him up to the top because he's got priority here at Game of Crimes.
Well, it's every episode that comes out, we always put their book goes to the top. So it remains that way until the next episode comes out.
There you go. Now that I'm in charge, my book's going back on top. No, I won't do that.
It just lets you know, too, Murph and I have worked a lot of things out. So I'll be helping him, making sure he can get his episodes out and do stuff. It's not just, hey, just dump you and run. So it's like, let's keep this thing going. Because, hey, look, I've got a lot of blood, sweat, and tears invested in this. I want to see it continue on, too.
And Morgan's trying to teach me how to do the editing and the recording. I'm actually recording this one today. This is my first recording. And I'm going to work on the editing and try to have this out on Monday. This is Saturday morning. There's no promises.
Now, Murph, here's my promise to you. We're going to get this episode out for you. So you get it downloaded. I'll work with you. We'll show you how to, we'll show you how to add the intro, outro, and all that good stuff.
Like I was telling you before we started, the record button here is, I think I was trying to learn too much too quickly. I was trying to learn how to do the video and audio. So we're just doing audio on this one. Video may be coming with Game of Crime soon if Murph can figure it out. We'll just have to see how it goes.
And like I said, man, don't overthink it. Don't overdo it. Just start small. Keep it simple, and then you'll work into it. But hey, and so that's kind of bring everybody up to speed. So it's like the other thing, too, you'll probably notice I'm not going to participate a whole lot in social media for a couple reasons. Number one, it's a time sink. You get involved in that, it's going down the rabbit hole. And I've got some very specific things with very specific timelines that are going to take a lot of effort, including we just put in another grant application for the National Center. So been working with the Virginia Chiefs, Chesterfield County Police. There's an opportunity to get some bigger funding from some major corporations. So anyway, it's just one of those things, it's not the end. I'm starting somewhere else. Murph's going to continue on and we're going to support him and make sure he becomes a huge star. He becomes a huge star. And then one of these days it's going to be, we'll see you on, one of the late night talk shows talking about your latest guest.
Yeah,
by the way,
I'll die and leave all, all the $38.27 we earned from the podcast to the kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, don't blow it all in one place,
right,
kiddos. Hey, before we get into this, let's do a recap now of, the Lost Clipper. So give us the lowdown, because I saw your pictures. First of all, that was just an amazing looking area. I saw you and Steve Klaus and and Guy and your dog handlers and the dogs. That just looked like, it was a bitch to get there, but once you got there, it was kind of like it was fun, because I saw you and your Speedo snorkeling out in the
ocean. Jeff Regal, he's always catching me in the best moments. What little bit of hair I have was sticking up. But and I'm going to bring I mentioned already, we're trying to get the artifacts that we discovered back here to the United States. So it's probably going to be a couple months. We want a forensic anthropologist to do an analysis to make it. We think it is. It is. But blast of a trip. Just had a fantastic time over there. We met a lady, Jill, who actually is a gringo, but she grew up in Chuuk, so she speaks Chuukese. She agreed to join us on the expedition, and she knew a lot of the people on the island of Tonawasis, which is the island we were searching. So she was a huge benefit. We found, I'll just tell you off the bat here, we found one piece of concrete that had chicken wire in it. Now, when you when you pour concrete, you don't put chicken wire. You put rebar in it for strength. And some of the fortifications that Japanese built back in the 1930s are still standing over there. So they knew how to build concrete structures. Well, the story is that they, when they killed the 15 Americans, they put them in this hole and they laid chicken wire across them to hold them down so that when they poured the liquid concrete in, the bodies didn't float up. Well, lo and behold, we found a piece of concrete, a good piece of concrete with chicken wire in it. We also found a piece of concrete with a shoe embedded in it. And then there's a few other artifacts. So, you know, this is the most we've ever found over there. The dogs alerted immediately. They were sent in separately. First one went in, sniffed around, sat down.
Yeah.
See, that's amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
Decades later, they still... And the other thing, too, is it's like you say, it's validation. It's not that they're sniffing on a piece of concrete and you go, well, what the hell's in there? They're sniffing on a concrete, but you know the concrete's already got chicken wire. And like you say, you've got a shoe. So there's already some indicia.
Oh, thank you.
Fancy word for an indicator that there's, yeah, there's something in there. And so the fact that the dogs hit on it after all these years, what does that tell you? You, when somebody dies in your place, you can't get rid of that smell.
Well,
like, forever.
I mean, it's amazing because where we believe they were originally buried because of typhoons and earth shift and all that that goes on, this was a considerable distance away. And thankfully, you know, we got a new guy on the team, Jim Janicki, who did a lot of, he applied a lot of science to our information. And that's how we found the location. I mean, we went there. We had gone a couple of days earlier to negotiate everything with the chief and get everything set up. And we asked him to clear out the area because there was a lot of trash and stuff in the way. And they did. And then we got there. We unloaded. We got everything set up. It's hotter than hell out there. It was about 89 degrees. The humidity literally was about 96%. You can stand in the shade and just stand there and sweat. And you had these two German Shepherd dogs. So we took huge kennels. We took bags of ice.
Oh, yeah.
We took fans, hydration kits, all kinds of stuff to keep these dogs in shape down there. And as soon as they went down, they immediately went down there and hit on the place. So it just tickled us to death. But so anyway, there will be more to come once we have more information. And I'll bring Guy on so he can tell you exactly what happened. This has been his baby for over 20 years, and we want to make sure he gets credit for everything.
Well, and that's the other thing, too. This is the fifth. This was the final one. It's like if you didn't find anything, that was it. And we talked about it, too. You when you guys were out pitching TV shows, nobody wants to do an Al Capone's vault again to where you show up, you open the door, and there's nothing there. And you know, Geraldo Rivera's got a, oh, well, there probably was something here, but nobody wants that kind of TV anymore. To your point, it kind of the burden's on you. But, you know, but on the other hand, though, now that you've gone to all this work, now that you've done it, you're in a much stronger position to negotiate and have
leverage. Our agents, the same agent represents you, represents Daniel Schmerz at United Talent Agency. And he's already been talking to the network, so we'll see where this goes. But, I mean, I appreciate you bringing it up. It's really exciting, and it's, you know, it also is our last trip because it was getting expensive. We've paid for everything. I think this time we had several companies. I talked to different people through friends who were interested in donating to us, and then they just ghosted us. There was one company, and I won't mention it right now. I'll let Guy mention that when the time comes, but they did donate $12,000, and that covered, I think, our hotel rooms and part of our meals while we were there because we had an 8-man team. So, you know, now if we're back in a position to negotiate a contract, I'm pretty sure the price has gone up.
Oh, the price definitely has gone up. Hey, real quick, though, tell me about the trip getting down there because you basically go halfway around the freaking globe.
Denver, from Orlando to Denver.
From Orlando,
then,
right?
A couple hours
Orlando
later,
to Denver.
Flew to Honolulu, 12-hour layover. So I met Jeff Riegel there. We met up in Denver. He barely made the flight because his flight out of Dulles was late leaving. We were already boarding the plane when he came running up. So he and I,
did his luggage make it?
And then we grabbed a hotel room. There's a Best Western close to the airport there, so we could get showers and get a nap. And then when you leave Hawaii going to Truk Lagoon, you don't go direct. You have to island hop. And the flight is going all the way to Guam. Guam is the last place. Truk Lagoon or Chuuk is the spot just before you get to Guam. So you stop on, I can't remember the names of the islands, but there's three or four islands that you have to stop on before you get there.
Now, did you have to change planes each time
island hop? The first island they would let you get off because it only stops there for an hour. And the other places, they wouldn't even let you get off. You just sat on the plane and they have security come on. You have to claim your luggage, all that stuff, and then you put it back up in the bins. And then the reverse, you leave Chuuk. We flew island hop back to Hawaii, another 11 and a half hour layover. That time I split a room with Jim Janicki. come back. We landed in Honolulu at 2:30 in the morning. And then, you know, of course, there's no shuttles running, so you get to hump it over to the hotel. And then he went one way. I think he was going to San Francisco. I flew back to, I think I went to L.A., and then L.A. to Orlando. So, you know, it's an ordeal, but it's an adventure. I love it. It's, you know, my wife thinks I'm an idiot, and I guess I am, but I love doing it.
Hey, now the important thing, though, from a fellow United Flyer 1K, you know, million-plus miler, did you get bumped up at least for a couple of the
longer
legs?
I'll be honest with you. I paid for this one. I didn't get a bump. I paid for first class. Yeah.
Ooh.
So that's why I'm going to keep running the show here, because I got to pay the ticket.
Got to pay for your trip. And I've seen those tickets before, Murph. I've looked at doing that before. There's a couple of times I bought the upgrade because I didn't want to leave it to chance. It's kind of like, you know, I can use my plus points, you know, or be in the queue. It's like, some of them, it was like, wasn't bad. It's like a 4-hour flight. It was only like $99 to upgrade. It's like, I'm doing that.
Even though you're on the other side of the world, but it wasn't as expensive as going to, say, Australia or New Zealand. I mean, those tickets are like $10,000.
Yeah.
So it wasn't anywhere near that, but
it was still significant
to the Murphy household. You know, and I really didn't tell Connie about it until right before I left. She said, how much do you pay for your tickets? I don't know if somebody told her something or what.
And then as you're getting out of the car running into the terminal, you go, don't worry about it. You know, it's on the
bill. Oh, and I told her I got to work.
But you should have looked at her and said, but mama's driving a good car too, aren't you, huh?
So anyway, it was a great trip. The good Lord he opens doors for you. And just like you talked about, these doors open for you this week. I love doing this. I love the people I work with. They're all fantastic. Klaus said to tell you hello. I hadn't seen him in quite a while. So it's all good.
What does he think of Florida? Because he's another treaters bastard.
They're in a very ritzy section. It's not Fort Myers, but it's close to Fort Myers. Yeah, not quite that ritzy, but
like
close
Sanibel
to it.
Or
I can't think
like
of the name
or
of the place he lives, but it's down in that area. And he said they wish they'd done it earlier. They just fell in love with the place.
Well, you know, Stephen did well for what he did up here. A lot of the fundraising he did and the projects he did, like with Mount Vernon.
Well,
you know,
with him,
and big
his,
stuff like that. The
his
heritage,
work
he,
has continued.
He did well.
He said, I hope, Stephen, if you hear this, I don't mean to let the secrets out here, brother, but he said he's making more money now than he ever did before. So, you know, life's good. Life's good.
That's why Steve could afford to pay. Well, Steve could afford to buy first class tickets. And
what did he tell me? He bought the Economy Plus refundable tickets because he says it gives you a better chance of getting bumped up. And he's 1K, but he didn't. He didn't get bumped up. Well, coming back, see, they were going to stay longer. I had my return ticket on the 10th, and we had planned to spend at least 2 days, if not 3 days, over on the island searching. But we found it the first day. We found everything. And we got into a little tiff with the chief there, but we got through it. We paid him. He was happy.
Oh, no. Again, like Murph, like we tell our guests, you just can't throw that out and then just move on.
Gone up. What?
When you say the chief,
he's like the guy in charge. I don't know if you call him a mayor, but everybody refers to him as a chief. And it's the guy we dealt with last time I was there. I met him then. I actually conducted an interview with him last time.
Okay.
And this time, we thought it was going to cost. If you step on somebody's property over there, you got to pay him. And when we were first going over there, it was like $2, maybe five. Well, this time they started out at 500. We thought it was going to be 500. It was 1500. And then he tried to come back later and say, well, you're taking pieces of cement off my property that were buried, and he wanted more money. Like you're going to dig the cement up, do something with it there, Buckwheat? So we had to negotiate that through, but we finally got through it, and Guy choked up the money and paid him off, and then a couple of us were chipping in to ship the concrete items back, because it's very expensive. I mean, it's like a couple $1,000. It took two of us to carry the first piece of concrete. It's probably everything together is a couple hundred pounds. Yeah. Yeah, and it's... Jim had to use his connections. Jim has his own business.
Wow.
He's got a couple of businesses, but he used his connections through DHL and he had to negotiate for like 3 weeks before he finally convinced him to do it. I don't know what's so difficult, but it's money in their pockets.
Ooh. Well, but the other thing too is, it's one of those things you have to check a box. You don't know for sure, but it's like, does it contain human remains?
Ooh.
No, we don't know. No, doesn't. We can't prove it. You know, have to wait. Now, what's going to be the process here? Because anytime you got something in concrete, I mean, you know, I've looked at what they've done with archaeology and stuff. So they've got their version of MRIs, you know, X-rays and MRIs and imaging, you know, to see what's in there first. But the real trick is going to be how do you get rid of that concrete without destroying what's underneath.
I'm curious. I asked Jim if they could do a dating of that shoe. You know, I don't know how you do that kind of stuff, but
yeah. Well, you can do carbon 14. I mean, the other thing too is like anything else. It's like if an FBI lab or somebody similar, you could look at the leather, you could look at the material, do a chemical analysis and say, okay, this is this kind of thing that was used during the 20s and 30s. Cause what they used to process leather and make stuff is far different than what they did now. So you could, you know, you're able to do, an analysis of the compositions and, you know, get all the readouts and see, okay, this one spikes. So that means it's this chemical, which was only used. I mean, it was amazing. The reason I know this is I was doing some research on the book and talked to some people that do work in some of the higher end forensic labs. And it's amazing what they can do with just a small sample now.
We're going to see. I mean, that would lend so much legitimacy to it, to the whole operation. If they come back and say that shoe, the chemicals and whatever is in that shoe was indicative of the chemicals that were used in 1937, 1938.
Now, did you get a look at the shoe? Could you tell the side of it? Was it a man, woman? Were you able to see it all?
Off to the side, and then it was that part of it was almost in an L shape, like it had been chipped away. So on the lower part of the L, you can see a part of a shoe print, and then on the upper, the up and down, the vertical piece of the L, you could see that's where the shoe, part of the edge of the shoe was embedded. It looked like maybe it had a rubber sole on it. That's about all you could see at that point.
So
I know it's, you know, to anybody that our listeners are probably thinking that's all you found. You spent all that money and that's all you found. Well, yeah, but it's better than we found anything before. And you know, if it, like I say, if it comes back from a forensic anthropologist as legitimate, then we've got a show.
Yeah, baby. Yes, you do. And the other thing too, is like you said,
there we be.
You got the chance to rewrite history. All righty. Well, we've done some catching up. We've prepped you for what's coming. So, let's just kind of hit a recap and we'll go through these episodes and we'll call it a day, as they say. So, but it was so fun. Yeah. Our buddy Wayne Stinnett has got us a lot of guests. He was a good guy, got us a lot of guests. And we said, well, let's get your ass on here. And when we did, when we started talking and he talked about, all I could think of, like I said, Keith Morrison, you know, Wayne Stinnett and the Curious Case of the Crocodile and Meth. Stuff he never...
No,
stuff. I've never found this kind of stuff during a search warrant. A crocodile. The dude, I think if I remember right, the guy in the house was going to race that crocodile to skin it to create a pair of gator boots.
Well, the funny thing was, Wayne told us they had already searched the place, and there was one door he hadn't opened. He thought, well, I better look in here, and he opened it up, and the curtain was closed on the bathtub, and he opened it up, and there's Mr. Croc. You talk about crapping your pants. I mean, can you imagine that thing turning around hissing at you? I'd have probably lit him up right there with a 9mm.
You know, that crocodile stuff might have just bounced off of his, you know, skull.
It's called Murphy's Law.
Yes.
Thanks. Oops. Sorry, partner. Didn't mean to shoot you in the ass. I got hit in the buttocks, sir. Well, so that was fun. But then I'll tell you, the other one, too, was Greg Gridders. And I think Greg was also another guest from Wayne Stinnett, wasn't he?
JR in Alabama. Javier and I have spoken. JR in Alabama has hosted Javier and a couple of things, and he's actually hosting us here in Orlando for a law enforcement conference later this year. And the first time we met all these cops in Alabama, just super people, man. They're like friends, they're like lifelong friends as soon as you meet them. And we were just telling them about our podcast, and they were saying, well, you know, there's a guy you need to get on here, Greg Gridders. And so I talked to Greg, and he kind of said, yeah, whatever. And I didn't hear anymore. And so the second time we went down there, which was the following year, Greg was there, and I got to talking to him. He's like, yep, give me a call. I'll be on your show. And that's, you know, you remember the story. Greg had convicted a former Alabama state trooper who got out of prison and came back to kill Greg because he was the prosecutor. He got a couple shots off. Greg laid down in his truck, which is what saved him. And then two police officers that Greg had just had lunch with heard the shots, came running around the corner, engaged the guy in a gun battle and killed him.
And as we said, but that wasn't. And so as we find out with many of our guests, it's always asking that next question and getting to the next level. Found out it wasn't his first brush with death. He was on a plane that crashed that killed quite a few people. And his dad and another family member survived by crawling out through the top of the fuselage.
Yep.
He's down to seven now. I mean, the way it's looking. But again, see, this is the fascinating part about having these guests on here. is you think it's about that story, but then you say, you know, you dig a little bit more. They just they do a throwaway line like you did. It's like, oh, we had a tiff with the chief. Oh, no, there's gold in them Nar Hills. Let's mine this a little bit. And we go digging like you did on Chook. We go digging and we find stories. You know, it's like, okay, getting shot at by. But right. you were in a
have
plane
you ever
crash.
Met anybody
I mean,
else
you,
in
how
your
many
life
times have you survived, death?
Plane crash? I haven't.
What a story. One person. And I'll tell you who it is. A guy named Dave Sanderson. I ended up meeting him in a mastermind group. We met as friends. This mastermind group we did met every year at Tennessee, and we worked during the year. He was the last guy off.
Oh, really?
The only plane crash where everybody survived, and it was the Miracle in the Hudson, Captain Sully. He's the last guy off that airplane, and he shouldn't have even been on that plane. He used to work for Oracle. Then he ended up working for Tony Robbins and doing his security for him, but then he worked for Oracle. He was living in North Carolina, I think it was, but he was headed back, he couldn't get on a flight. This was the last flight. The last seat was the middle row in the very back. And Dave Sanderson is a big guy. He's bigger. Not quite as big as Lou, but pretty close to Lou Velozzi. So when you see the picture of them crawling out, he is up to his waist in water. He is leaning out of the emergency exit, and he's the last guy out of the plane. Yeah. And that's he's launched his whole speaking business. If you guys want to know, it's called DaveSandersonSpeaks.com. Hey, there's a free – I'm going to start charging people for all of these free ads we give them. Then, Murph, this next one. You and I were at the Southern California Game Conference where we got a lot of good stories. Yeah. And this was we debated this a little bit too because it was kind of like this next guy is not even though he's leading – he's walking the walk, I do believe now. But this was, we talked back and forth on Ramon Mundo Mendoza,
was
shot caller for the Mexican
17
Mafia.
When he committed his first murder. I think it was 15, wasn't it? He killed a kid with a machete.
I think he was 15 or...
Yeah.
Yeah, I think probably
you know,
15.
His
down, I think it was down
interview
at that
with
pool
us,
hall.
We did the first interview with him in person out in San Diego in this room. And Mundo was very cordial. He's very polite. But man, he just had that look like, don't take this guy. I'm sitting there looking at him. I'm thinking, I don't have a gun. I don't have a knife. I don't even have a bottle I can hit him in the head with. You know, this is, and he's older than we are, but not a man I would mess with. But his interview, if you remember, his interview was so proper. It was so popular. Yep. You know, Game of Crimes, people ask us to bring him back. So not only was he episode 103. Yeah. We had him back on 112.
He was our first return guest.
I expect I'll see him out here. I'm going out to San Diego again at the end of May.
Yeah, and the thing about that, though, we did get some folks saying, you know, why'd you interview this? Well, look, Game of Crimes is. It's about the most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. Here's a guy. This is one of the reasons why people like him came out to the game conference. It's why one of the other guests that we have coming up, the son of the Cali cartel. Why do you go in? And I know there's some people say, I'm not going to talk with him. I'm not, you know, it's like Chris Feistel and Dave Mitchell. They say, no, you know, we don't want to be on the same stage. And I get that. But, and look, no, I wouldn't want to but you know what though? But I do want people to learn. How do they think? How did they think about law enforcement? What was the relationship between them and law enforcement? Right. How did they operate? How did they organize? How did they collect intelligence? You know, if you don't understand your adversary, you can't defeat your adversary. And how much would you, when you were going after Pablo, part about going after Pablo was learning everything about him. I mean, it would have been, because what did you do with everybody that's in Pablo's organization that you got a hold of? You'd want to interview him. You'd want to debrief him and learn from him. So this is how you teach cops for the future about, and it's, and unlike popular myth that you see on TV and stuff, not all of these guys are that way. A funny thing I found out from talking to Mundo is they really didn't want to engage the cops. They wanted to, you know, they wanted to keep the beef between themselves. So whenever, you know, like cops around, a lot of them were just like cooperative.
It was.
But it's amazing.
And
the stories we got
open
out of Mundo. And he
comes
had so many
very
plus
honest.
His book.
He didn't hold back. And we'll get into the William Rodriguez Abadia here in a minute, because it's completely different.
Very completely different. And so then we are out again. We're out at the Southern California Gang Conference. So who do we catch up with? We catch up with John Mattingly, which was episode 79. He kicked off our first of the year episode that year. And you know what, Murph? That episode there, I still to this day, I see bullshit going across X or social media where they're talking about Breonna Taylor and this whole incident.
Did you see the posting? I saw John posted on, I don't know if it's X or Instagram, but the actor that plays Jack Reacher, big muscle guy, big stud guy.
Yep.
I tell you what.
Me either. Me either.
I saw that guy's wearing a t-shirt that says, I'm not arrest the cops that killed again. Breonna Never Taylor. Again.
It wasn't the cops. It was her freaking boyfriend.
Yeah.
And then got her killed.
Who fired the first shot. Yeah. Oh, and he left the boyfriend, left her in the hallway. No blood on him. He never attempted to save her ass. He never attempted to pull her out of the line of fire. He fires the first shot. And then as we found out too, the little, a lot of people who want to judge John.
Yeah. And they also forgot that maybe that, you want to check the facts about what really happened before you make a decision and vilify a whole police agency, including a man who was the only person wounded other than Breonna Taylor, who is the person that said there's absolutely no reason Breonna Taylor should have died that day. So, you know, I can't think of the actor's name. And if I could, I would say it just embarrassing. But, dude, we're done with you.
Let me tell you. I'm going to pull it up because actor, Jack Reacher actor. Alan Richson.
We're done with you, buddy.
So, hey, Alan.
Best thing you can do is come back and apologize. And you know what? He wasn't the only one. Our vice president, Kamala Harris, actually came out in favor of Breonna without knowing the facts. So, yeah, let's.
And are we biased? Yeah, we're biased because we've been trained. We were, you know, brought up in a profession where you had to follow the facts. You go, you know, you don't. You get in trouble when you invent facts, not when you follow them. So when you follow the facts. And that's, you know, I can tell you, Murph, a couple cases I had where you follow the facts. I remember on one sexual assault case, we had a composite, had enough information for probable cause, arrested the guy, brought him in, started talking with him, realized quickly, you ain't the guy. It was his brother because we followed the facts. But we had enough to make the arrest, but not to convict. And as we started getting into this, like, we need to let you go. And from the facts, we were able to arrest his brother, secure a conviction. But if that was the case, too many people, and I've seen this happen in law enforcement, you have too.
Right.
Yeah, you get wedded to the outcome. It's like, nope, this is the guy, no matter what. Well, you know, this is the guy.
And for our listeners, just like we always say, don't let the media tell you what to think or the politicians, you know. Find out what the topic is and do your own research, and then you decide what's right and what's wrong. This thing where the media has just gotten, you know, so biased, whether it's left, right, I don't know of any that are down the middle now. But they think that they should have the right to tell us what to think. And that just burns me up. Every time Javier and I talk, whether it's a public audience, law enforcement, whatever the audience is, I always point that out. You're intelligent. You've got your own mind. You can make a decision. You decide. Don't let anybody else tell you what to think. And there.
Yeah. And and then we just had a couple quick, you know,
canceled.
John told us about an incident he had when he was going to speak and people found out he was there and they, you know. Everybody threw a fit again without the facts, but then we caught up with Joe Pistone. Always fun.
Joe
was episode 73.
I mean, you talk about
such a fun
like
guy.
To hear our story.
You know?
When Javier and I sit down with Joe, we could just sit there kind of in awe of this guy because he's got some stories, man. Undercover for 6 years against the mafia family. Holy cow. This guy's a stud in my book.
And here's the thing, too, is he could have been killed. Not because he was an FBI undercover, but because he was a mobster, quote, you know, somebody who was in the family, that if he had crossed somebody and had the meeting, like we found out, you know, from one of our other favorite mobsters, too, you get called to have a meeting, and it's like Michael Franzese, you know, like, am I walking out of this meeting
Donnie
or am
Brasco
I not?
So
Brasco, that was a thing
that's what Brasco
Donnie Brasco, you know, had to do a couple times. Yeah. Brascojones. Brasco.
Yep.
Hey, but you know the one I thought was interesting? We caught up with Bob Mazur. He was, you know, did The Infiltrator. Bryan Cranston played him in that movie. And then come to find out, because you and I met this douche nugget, not Bob, but the guy we're about to talk about in the waiting room, the green room. It was the guy who ratted him out. It was the guy who sold him out to the cartel while he was down in country doing an operation. And this guy comes in.
Yep.
And what did I predict? I told you. I said he's gonna cry and make it about him. And it's exactly what he fucking did. He got up there on the stage and tried to cry. It's about, you know, you don't understand what it's like. No, we do. You're a fucking rat. You ratted out one of your people. And what was instructive is I know Santi and the guys, Mel, they were nice to him. They were in the green room.
Just to remind our listeners, he was a Tampa police officer. Nobody sat around him. Task force officer for the DEA in Tampa. And that's when Bob was doing the undercover against the Medellin cartel. He was doing the money laundering side of the Medellin cartel. And this jerk rats him out and lets him know. And they didn't believe him. That's the only reason Bob Mazur made it back to the United States. So all three of those guys, I think all three of them are going to be in San Diego again this year. So I'll get to see them. I don't know that I'll do an update with them on Game of Crimes, but at least I'll get to see them.
Yeah. Well, but this, and then what was interesting is then both Bob Mazur and this snitch go out on stage, and it's the first time they had talked, and the guy
You're
still
exactly right.
If I remember, right, he still didn't really apologize or take responsibility for what he did.
I screwed you. I apologize. I can never make it up to you, but he didn't. It's poor me, poor me. It's just poor little me. Screw you, pal. You took an oath and you betrayed your oath. You betrayed all your brothers and sisters in law enforcement. Screw you.
Well, and worse than that, betrayed somebody knowing that they would probably get killed if they were caught.
And I got to tell you, going undercover in a foreign country like that is extremely rare. You know, back in the old days, it was common. But during the time of Escobar and all that, it was extremely rare that they would allow anybody to come and do it. So, I think Bob came in and did the meeting. I'm not even sure he spent a night in Colombia. Anyway. Enough bitching.
Yeah. Well, and out of that, we launched William Rodriguez Abadia. The way this is going, we might have to do three parts. I don't know. We got started late, but the son of the original founders of the Cali cartel, he definitely was slick. He was smooth. You could tell he was trained as a lawyer. But the one funny line he delivered when I was listening to him speak, he says, I'm sorry if I'm a little nervous. He says,
and the
I'm
cops
not used
even
to having
laughed.
This many cops in front of me. They were usually behind me.
Yeah, that was
me.
Good. Man, we're talking, there's close to 1,000 police officers sitting in this auditorium.
Yeah.
That's funny.
But again, here's another guy who never took responsibility. He deflected. And the other thing too, you'll see it in the episode notes, but he was represented by a guy that is just, every time I was around him, his quote, his agent, his
rep, because that
checked my wallet to make sure it was still there, to make sure my watch was still on
my wrist. Pablo Escobar's son. You know, he's the one that tried to get Javier and I to go on the stage. We were doing a Northern European tour back before COVID, and he'd contacted our agent and said, hey, I think you guys are going to be, it's in Denmark or Finland, one of the countries over there, and, be here at the same time. It'd be great to put all three of them on stage together. Our agent called, he said, our agent called me and he said, look, I think I know the answer, but
and
I've got to present the offer to you.
Right.
And after he did, I said, I'm going to send this to you in writing so you never ask me this question again. And I did. And he has it.
And the lady that accompanied him was the sister of the lady who was with Sean Penn, who disrupted the El Chapo arrest, which
she
we had
piece work too.
Perez and Paul Crane on to talk about.
Attribute was the girl sticking out that she had hanging out of her blouse. And then we found out later. That you had to roll your tongue
really,
back up. What are you talking about?
I didn't notice. Really? She had.
But, then we found out that night they ran off. His agent and the girl ran off down to Tijuana for the evening and left William with us, which we capitalized on.
Yep. And let me tell you how we capitalized on it. So we brought him back to Murph's suite. I happen to have a bottle of wine, and I did. If he's listening, I just gave away the trick, but he was reluctant to talk even after the first glass of wine. But I pretended to drink wine. I had maybe a quarter glass of wine. He drank the entire bottle.
And this wasn't for criminal
prosecution. And by the time we got
thing.
Done, this dude was telling us
so
everything.
No harm, no foul. Go ahead. Oh, we won't
and
tell
he says,
anybody.
Well, I'm really not supposed to say this, but we won't tell just between us and everybody who's listening. So, but it was fun. But again, here's another guy who's never taken full responsibility. There was always, now I wasn't really involved in that part of the business. I only did this side.
Absolutely.
Dude, you were involved in the death of people. You were involved in the ordering of hits. I get it. You're not going to admit it now because you don't want to be prosecuted, but we know, and we know. Well, here's a buddy of yours, the next one, episode 106.
Tony's
I like it. Tony Placido
agent.
And 9mm guacamole.
He is one of the best supervisors I've ever worked for. When I first got promoted up to the senior executive service ranks, they moved me from operations over into the intelligence division. And Tony was he was in charge of the entire intelligence division worldwide for DEA. And I'd met Tony throughout my career, but the first day I came up to headquarters in the 12th floor, that's where all the big bosses sit down there in Crystal City. And he comes walking out of his office, sees me walking down, and he goes, Murph! And he comes running up. And Tony is a big man. Picked me up off the floor, gave me the biggest bear hug. I mean, I just love the guy. He just supported you 110%. He let you run your own shop. Doesn't always happen, But he had some great cases that I wasn't aware of. They talked about,
and I like the hope when he was in country, and they just you got to listen to it though. We're not going to go through and recap everything. But if you haven't listened to this, go listen and listen to the story about 9mm guacamole. Yeah, and so every now and then, you know, we would diverge. Episode 109 is Jason Redmond. Jason was a former Navy SEAL. Yeah, 107. I'm sorry. Yeah, 107. I'm just so excited. I was jumping ahead episodes. 107, but. He's famous for a couple things. Number one, he survived a significant, you know, ambush, wounded, bad wounds, and outside of Fallujah, which was a hotspot for terrorist activity. But he fought back. But one of the things he did, which one of our later guests or earlier guests used, he created a sign, and that's kind of what he's famous for. So if you go search on the interwebs, Al Gore's Amazing Internet, Jason Redmond, the sign, you're going to see what that whole story is about. But man, here's another guy, too. In spite of everything that was given to him, he turned it into a positive. He's delivering the kind of
he's outstanding.
Inspiration
he's
that I think people
American
need to have.
Patriot,
and
hero.
He was fun to talk to.
We've gotten to be friends since that time. He was with us at the Military Appreciation Weekend in Beaufort, South Carolina a couple months ago. Got to meet his wife. Man, he's got a speaking business now that is phenomenal, doing leadership courses, doing motivational speaking, telling his story. If you're looking for speakers, check him out. He's not cheap, but he's worth the money. I'll tell you that. So,
well, just like you and Javi, Murph, when you guys go out and speak, good things are seldom cheap, and cheap
yeah,
things are
true.
Seldom
that's
good.
True.
You ever seen a cheap speaker?
No, that was.
It's
I
pretty
tell
easy
you, this,
to figure out in the first
one. We just
minutes.
Got home from in Tahoe. The guy that ran everything is Scott Savage, retired FBI agent, and he gave us the best compliment. We finished speaking. We were the last speaker of the conference. We finished up at about 5:30. On Thursday afternoon, and they were having their big gala dinner that night, and he got up to dismiss, but before he left, he said, listen, I want to thank you guys. He said, the fact that you're the last speaker of the conference, and there wasn't a single soul that got up and left this room, they stayed until 5:30 to hear your entire story, that's a testament to your story and you guys. So I don't know that we've ever gotten a better compliment. So Scott, if you're listening, brother, thank you very much for that.
And I've been to conferences, too, to where if you're standing between me and free booze and
you
suck as a
cops
speaker.
Can be very cold.
Boom.
Yep.
Just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts. Speaking of the facts, we got some great facts out of this next guest. Episode 108, John Norris and the real truth behind the cartels and cannabis. Everybody thinks marijuana, cultivating marijuana doesn't really hurt anybody. This is when he starts dropping some facts on your head and you realize how much damage is being done to the environment. So if you're an environmental wacko out there, as I think Rush Limbaugh used to say, but if you're dedicated to the environment, you can't be dedicated to the environment and support this cultivation of marijuana at the same time, because what these guys are doing is destroying, not literally, actually destroying the vegetation,
John was fantastic.
Ecological system, the ecosystem out there.
One of the best
books
I've ever read. I think it was so eye-opening to hear about, 8 billion gallons of water had been diverted from Southern California during the drought to grow the marijuana? 8 billion, not million, billion gallons. So this year for the conference in San Diego, I talked to Mel and Santee and recommended John, and he's going to be one of the guest speakers this year. So probably going to have a little catch up with John after he does his presentation out there, and that'll be a future episode here on Game of Crimes.
Yep. Well, and then somebody that you had met to at a previous conference, Julie Redke. Her background, her story was so amazing, and what she did to go forward and start leading. She went from Big Brothers, Big Sisters to the police athletic league. Try saying that. Police athletic league, pal. What a story. And I met up with her in D.C. We went out and had coffee, talked with her about what it's like in a nonprofit,
et cetera. When I first met her,
she was involved
with Big Brother, Big Sister. She was one of the executive vice presidents for them. And she asked me to come up and be their national speaker or their speaker at their national conference. And I did. But as we're discussing it, I heard Julie's story. And I got her to tell me her story. And it's one of the most motivational stories I ever heard. One of how she grew up in such a terrible situation. Her father was a drug user and a drug dealer. Was killed by another drug dealer. She didn't let the circumstances bring her down. She pulled her bootstraps up, as they say, is a cliche saying, but that's exactly what she did. Went to law school. Now she's an attorney. She's extremely successful, happily married. And as a matter of fact, Connie and I owe them a dinner, so we're going to head to Tampa here sometime in the next month or two and meet up with her and her husband for dinner. Just one of the sweetest people I've ever met.
Well, what was funny is one of my other buddies who's been a big supporter of the podcast, I've worked with him on the National Center for Open and Unsolved Cases, Rick Zach from Microsoft. Rick has a bad habit with humor, of going somewhere and then you guys send me a selfie flipping me the bird. Well, he was at an ICP dinner or something with Julie, and even though he's given me the bird, Julie was so classy.
Well, here, she just waved. Julie. Here's a double.
Julie didn't give me the bird like you did. She has class. You don't. Here's a double. I'll make up for her. Yeah. You know, I'm her proxy. So here's me. Here's her. There you go. All right. So episode 110 is a guy I've been working with for quite a while. He helped me get to where I'm at now. And then now we're going to launch into bigger heights. But Ryan Steck, you know, it was fun to talk with him just because he's a younger guy, but he's worked with some of the big authors like Jack Carr, Brad Thor. He's even talked to Brett Berejik, Jake Tapper about their books. And so, you know, it's just talking Now, this is unusual because we turned this into an episode, but then later on, you're going to see we decided to start taking authors and give them just their own spot on Thursdays. Just call it like Author's Corner. But it was Ryan, for a young kid, you know, I say young, you know, he's in his 30s, but he's got a full family doing this full time. But he writes a new kind of a Western thriller. It reminds me of, you know, he's up there in, I believe it's Montana. And a guy named Matthew Redd is a former Marine Raider, and which is interesting because you've heard about SEALs and Rangers, but and, nobody ever writes his about stories Marine Raiders. So we got a story about a Marine Raider out of this one, Murph.
As well as entertaining. And for him to be as open as he was to tell us a story and then step up and helping you out, getting your first book off the ground, and I mean, what a nice guy, you know? Really nice guy. Well, you should.
He's still a capitalist pig at heart. I have to pay for this shit, Murph. It ain't free.
You should fork that over. That's about the truth.
Now, I spent that last week on a latte at Starbucks. So, hey, we'll just touch real quickly. But one of the fun things we got, though, Kathy Reichs came on and talked about her latest killer thriller, The Bone Hacker. But Kathy was the inspiration behind Bones, which has been long running on TV. It was so interesting listening to her. I know she was doing on a book tour, so we only had her for like 45, 50 minutes. But I read her latest book, you know, but somebody who can just turn out, you know, product year after year, you know, like she does, consistently good. And then they turn it into a long-running TV series.
Book,
it's like
I read it before we did the interview.
That's what I'm aiming
it
for.
It's a spellbinder. I mean, it keeps you on your edge of your seat until the very end. So we highly recommend it. Take a look at the website for us, and you'll see her book on there.
Yep. Well, we head into episode 111, getting back to my part, my neck of the woods. This is from Oklahoma, Branson Perry. Now, Branson, he's another Wayne Stinnette, you know, guy. But Branson started off, though, as an Oklahoma State trooper. And you know what? I go back and I think, was my first night on the job. No, wasn't big, but his first night on his own.
I know.
He had a standoff.
I mean, he's a rookie out on the road before. And gets in a somewhat of a chase and ends up in a standoff between the troopers and the sheriff's department. And the sheriff shows up and says, nobody's going to leave. Somebody's going to jail. Well, Branson's about as big as a house. Come on over here, buddy.
Well, and it's like what we put in here. The phrase was boys or no, get your gun, boys. That was the start of the most unique standoff, I think, in Oklahoma history.
And as you know, if you listen to the episode, Branson didn't go to jail. In fact, I think the sheriff, once he saw Branson's size, kind of backed down.
No.
There you go.
Renegotiated the terms of our surrender here. You know, we're willing to. But then what was funny, though, like you, but he went on to become a stud in criminal interdiction, took a lot of dope, a lot of things off the road. But the thing, again, here you go being targeted. His life was disrupted for what was it, at least 2 years by an ACLU lawsuit. No, 3 years of litigation. And then they finally resolved it. 3 years his life is turned upside down. You know, I don't mind the fact that, look, there always needs to be oversight. Mm-hmm. But you know what? He was out there doing his job, doing the way he ought to do it.
Yep.
And he has to spend 3 years of his life defending himself against frivolous litigation.
I said bullshit.
Did you say bullshit? 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 Well, then we go to episode 112.
Yes.
We won't dive into it other than this was Mundo, our first repeat customer, I believe. But the one thing that came out of this, though, we dive more into his message to law enforcement, the parents, and the community on what it takes to keep kids out of gangs. You know, just solid advice from somebody who was there. He said, if I had had this, I never would have joined the gang.
I mean, this is convicted
that's
murder.
Pretty credible stuff, you know, to me, and from somebody who lived the life he did.
Things like that, I think it's worthy of listening to, especially for young people.
Yeah, and then but this is the one, too. This was a tough one. You listen to the facts. You don't. It's not like, oh, good for you. You got away with it. But he conducted a Mexican mafia sanctioned hit while he was, quote, undercover. But he went rogue. And how he was able to avoid prison time is that's you'll have to listen to the episode if you haven't already listened to it. Yep. So then this was a guy I believe you got introduced to, Ty Holland, with Operation Underground Railroad.
I can't remember how I got introduced to Ty, who made us the introduction, but he's one of the bosses with Operation Underground Railroad, which is dedicated to trying to recover victims of human trafficking. They won't go into a lot of details, obviously, for good reason, because everything they do needs to be secret in order to save lives. But they're successful. And not to talk bad about the creator of Operation Underground Railroad, he's no longer with them. So if you want to do some research on your own, I'm not going to spend time talking about it. The guy left a cloud over it, and they've straightened it out, and they're back to producing results. And I don't know if you know this, Morgan, but one of our previous guests has actually done some work for him, Mr. Lou Velozzi. So he's done.
We talked about him going down in country.
Hats off to Lou for continuing to do the right thing.
Yep. So the other thing we always want to do, too, we want to make sure we get different voices in here. And this is this next guest, episode 114, Sergeant Betsy Brantner Smith, longtime friend of mine, along with her husband, Dave Smith. If you haven't, you have to go to the interweb, go look up JD Buck Savage, and there's a link in the episode. He was Arizona DPS. Dave has become a very well-renowned, police trainer, the Winning Minds series of seminars, used to teach street survival, things like that. But Betsy was fun, though, because she doesn't hold back. She is a fierce advocate for the men and women of law enforcement, and she survived breast cancer. She's a cancer survivor. She kicked its ass. They take their Winning Minds seminars all over the place. I've stay in touch with them, follow them on Twitter, Facebook, and they're always someplace new. But I mean, Betsy, from what she did to where she is now and what she does, as a spokes, representative for, for the National Police Association, she is now on TV all the time. She used to say, I want to be on TV like you.
Well, Betsy, you're on far more than I have been. She kept you laughing the whole time. That was a really, really good interview. I love doing that one.
Oh, yeah. Stud.
Well, I love doing this next one too, because Rick Prado, this is the type of guy that would, death from above, you wouldn't hear it coming. He was a freaking operator. He was CIA. He has a book out there too called Black Ops, The Life of a CIA Shadow Warrior. But he was at CIA headquarters on 9/11 and actually led, which I happen to have
like
one
me.
Of the
that,
challenge
you
coins
move
here
away
for.
From the microphone from you. Give me
as
shit when I don't do that. That's what you just did.
I just did that because I had to turn around. So he ran Operation Jawbreaker out of CIA. So cool. I happen to have from the CIA
very
store,
nice.
I actually have the Operation Jawbreaker challenge coin. And
very cool.
9/11/01. Yep. And here are people who serve in the shadows, who served. They didn't do it for the glory because their names could never be known. Mm-hmm. Their operations could never be known. The only time you hear about them is when something went bad, when something went south. You don't hear about their successes. You only get to hear about the failures.
Javier and I had a hard time with them, with their chief of station in Bogota. The rest of the guys, the field guys, we had no problems with at all. We got along great with them. But we kind of lump everybody together. Yep. But I also say that I have the greatest respect for the CIA. I think they do a fantastic job. There are times when they screw up just like everybody else. The thing is, they can't tell us about their successes because everything they do is secret. So, you want to have a bad opinion about them, that's fine. You can jump on that that bandwagon with everybody else that doesn't know what the hell they're talking about. Or you can do some research on them and find out, Where would we be without him?
Well, Murph, but you bring up a point. We kid each other all the time, but I always used to say the problem was never at the agent level, you know, or in the case of the CIA, politics. The case officer level. It was never at the operator level. It was always at the agency level when the politics got involved. That's where the problems were. The problems weren't you and me working together on a task force. So, I mean, I worked with the marshals. I worked with DEA. I worked with ATF, worked with FBI. I mean, I worked with all the problem was never with the people we worked with. It was always and to your point, too, DEA makes a huge arrest, takes down an organization. Press release, if it's big enough, the attorney general does it. The director, you know, is there, or the administrator, you know.
Right.
But when the CIA disrupts something, you can't talk about it because so much of their stuff, right, has to remain in the shadows. But anyway, Rick Prato, this is us saluting you, brother. I don't ever want to get on your bad side. And this was fun too, because this is the brother of a guy and his and the brother's daughter that we met at the gang conference. Eric McBride was deputy chief in San Bernardino during the 2015 San Bernardino terrorist attack.
It was eye-opening. That was quite the confusion that was going on.
To him about what went on there.
It was almost mass mayhem on the police side because so many agencies were responding from other jurisdictions. I mean, you need to listen to the interview because it's going to sound bad when I say it, but a lot of cops just wanted to come and see what was happening. They're like spectators. You know, there was no organization. Eric is getting in there trying to get everything organized as the deputy chief because, you know, I think he said there was over 300 police officers responded to that. What a cluster, you know, I mean, holy cow. But yeah, Eric is the brother of Jamie McBride and his niece is Tony McBride. His brother, Jamie, is a retired Los Angeles police officer, and Tony is a current Los Angeles police officer. So we're hoping to get them on the show at some time. We've been trying for a couple of years, and we'll be successful. I mean, our list of potential guests is still as long as it ever has been since we started the show. So hopefully we'll get them on there.
And let's just remember that these two pieces of shit killed 14 innocent people, wounded another 22. So another case of Islamic terrorism. You know, they declared their intentions, who they aligned with. So great job with those. Now, this next one, though, is another friend of yours, Charles Lutz. And what I liked about him, you don't. My dad was a World War II, but a Vietnam vet. He started off his life as a newly commissioned butter bar, as they say, in 01,
he wanted to get into the action. Well, he did. He got a bronze star for bravery.
What did you think I was going to say?
And got stationed in Miami. Man, I thought he had no fucking idea
who you were.
Surprise, surprise. But you know what? He and I have stayed in contact since then, since we did his interview.
It's like, Murph.
Yeah.
Didn't know. Yeah. Had no idea. It reminds me, did you remember watching the movie The Dirty Dozen? Remember the scene where Donald Sutherland is supposed to be the general and he's walking up and down the line and they don't want him to do that, but he starts interviewing him from. He goes, "Where are you from, son?" "I'm from someplace in Iowa." And he looks at him and he goes,
"Classics.
Never heard of classics." It just keeps moving.
Well, you know, and
I didn't know. I wasn't going to mention that, but since you did, I said, okay, it's fair game. But,
well, he actually got transferred to headquarters, and then I got selected to go to Columbia after that. So he was my ASAC for a couple years, maybe 3 years. But I had lost track of his career, and to listen to him, everything he was involved with, from running Operation Snowcap for a while and being down in Peru and then getting involved once he left DEA, getting involved with TSA and, you know, starting the TSA program here in Orlando Airport. And the guy's still involved in stuff. And just another example of how, you know, what we say in here is just because we retire doesn't mean our oath expires. And Charlie Lutz is living up to that.
Yeah. And I think if I remember right, Orlando was the first airport to completely deploy everything for TSA. I mean, they were first one to come online. I can't remember what it was, but they were first in the nation to achieve everything that they wanted to do from a TSA standpoint. Yeah.
Surprises.
Not in government. Never you mean cease. On budget and ahead of schedule, under budget and ahead of schedule? That's a work of fiction. Yeah, let's put that in the fiction aisle. Well, this next one was fun too, because here is proof that you can go from being just a, you know, a street cop, you know, and a ground pounder and a grunt to being a world famous author, Mark Cameron. And it was so fun to talk to Mark because starting off where he didn't, but the geography couldn't be different. He starts off in Texas, but ends up in Alaska, which is where a lot of his Arliss Cutter novels are set. Mark was also picked to take over the Tom Clancy estate. He wrote a few novels, then he gave it up, and now Andrews and Wilson have taken it over.
It is. It is.
But he wrote seven novels in the Tom Clancy series.
We've got another writer
series.
Here that we're going to talk about freaking before amazing. We finish this. But I'm shocked at how some of these agents go into writing afterwards that are being, you know, significantly successful. That's great.
Why is that so amazing? Yeah. I mean, they were used to writing reports, you know, approach suspects, saw subject, arrest the same. You know, I mean, there's a novel, beginning, middle, and end. Every novel has to have a beginning, middle, and end. Dispatch to the call, saw subject with a gun, shot him, case over, you know. All right, so this next one, this was interesting. Mm-hmm. We won't get into some of the backstory, but you know where I'm going with this, Murph, too, because of the Southern California Gang Conference. But Ed is an interesting guy. It took us a while to get things arranged to get him on, but he goes from being a punk in his own words. These are his own words. He said to one of the most effective police forces ever in Baja, Mexico. But the problem was they were trying to get rid of bad cops. The cartel was getting involved. And then when he was given the choice to stay in a line with cartel or leave,
he threw everything in a car and drove across the border. He wasn't going to stay there. He's on the speaking circuit. He is hard to get a hold of. I don't know that it's him. I think it's the people that I don't know if he calls them an agent or a company that helps him with his speaking events, but they are very slow to respond, to be quite honest. Ed, if you're hearing this, I'm not sure that they're helping you out a lot there, brother. But yeah, so
get off your ass and into the war, Ed. Come on, let's go. Gang conference chop, chop.
Unfortunately, we'd love to have him out there, but just didn't work out. But you got to, you know, through his story, I mean, you got a really good look
at
how
Mexican
cops operate in Mexico, because there's a hell of a lot of corruption down there.
And I'll tell you what, you know, when we were talking about this just now, I went, had a quick flashback because we the wife and I rewatched Narcos, and then we watched Narcos Mexico. So, and then, you know, you finish up in Narcos Mexico, there's this one cop, you know, they're corrupt, but he gets involved in trying to track down girls that are being kidnapped, you know, they're disappearing. It's just when I saw this and I looked at that, I said, man, I see it. They were, mm-hmm. I mean, at least by what Ed said, that's so accurate in the terms of the portrayal of what these guys were dealing with, you know, and, you know, you got the badge, you got the gun, you got the car, but on the one hand, you're taking money from the cartel to go do hits. But on the other hand, you're, you know, responding to calls and arresting people. Such a schizophrenic life down there. I didn't know you knew that word, Murph. Is that for birth control or what? Where is that? You got the power now, bro. Hey, do you have a pause button, dude? Does this have a mute and pause and nuclear and eject button? Does it eject the seat out too?
Hey, players, this is the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, go and check us out on X, formerly Twitter, at Game of Crimes, on Facebook and Instagram at Game of Crimes Podcast, and on our website, GameOfCrimesPodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including our book list. Any book written by our guests will be listed there. If you're looking for even more, go to patreon.com/GameOfCrimes. It's where we post a lot more content you won't hear on our regular podcast. We go into a lot more topics, and folks, it's just plain old fun. That's patreon.com/GameOfCrimes. In the meantime, everyone stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.